Listen to those of us who want to speak. Thinking will be declared the national language. Birds will be allowed to share their wisdom. Cabinet meetings will have new agendas. The truth and Neruda will be discussed. There will be policy analysis on important matters, such as love and dignity. I don't know about you, but I say let the poets run the country. We have leaders who speak from the heart, people who will not take into account the money of thieves and liars. We will have a country filled with rhymes and justice if for once we let the poets run the country.
That is the voice of Kike Aviles, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the studios of the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by MET Studios' Mike Turpin. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by Avideh Shoshani, the Sinipet Fund, Anne Arundel Arts Council, Rivada Foundation, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Good morning, everybody. This is DK Home with another episode of Film at 11. This week, we're going to hear from Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time and Jeff Godsell of the Essentials of Cinema website. But first, two movies that share a lot in common. Two recently released films both address issues arising in that still alive time, the 60s, 70s. The Glorias is about Gloria Steinem, journalist, feminist, and founder of Ms. Magazine. And The Boys in the Band is a restaging of the play for Netflix. They join other current and forthcoming 60s efforts, such as the TV show Mrs. America about anti-feminist Phyllis Schlafly, and the forthcoming film about the Chicago Seven.
Those are too big. They hide your beautiful face.
They're perfect.
Those women in bunny outfits are going to thank you one day.
Fear of public speaking. What Dorothy and I have to say is too important not to say it.
This is the year of women's liberation.
A simple right to reproductive freedom is basic.
We're here to make revolution, not just...
The Glorias is directed by Julie Taymor of theatrical fame and stars Julianne Moore as Gloria Steinem. The movie follows her childhood with a peripatetic father, her entry into journalism, her turn to feminism, and the foundation of Ms. But in a gimmick, Julianne Moore is joined by Alicia Vikander and two other actresses of differing ages to play Gloria Steinem. It's kind of like the way Cate Blanchett played Bob Dylan with other people in I'm Not There, the biopic from Todd Haynes. The film is hagiographic, and there's nothing wrong with that, but you feel as if you're not learning anything new and that a lot is being left out. For example, I remember seeing Gloria Steinem and Taymor being interviewed on television about this film, and she told an anecdote about Terry Southern when asked if she ever had any Harvey Weinstein-type incidents ever occur to her. She said she was waiting in the lobby of her agent's, her literary agent, and sitting next to her was another client who was a famous novelist and writer at the time, who started talking about her appearance and told her they'd really like to kiss her, and then tried to do that, at which point she reached up and clawed his face, scarring it in a way that he bore the scar for the rest of his life. She didn't want to say who it was, but it turned out to be, of all people, Terry Southern, the screenwriter of Dr. Strangelove. I just wish there was more of that kind of gritty life in the film. But meanwhile, the boys in the band reassembles the cast from the recent Broadway revival under director Joe Mantello, and it's produced by Ryan Murphy.
Who's coming?
Same old tired fairies you've seen around since day one.
This is gonna be fun.
This old college friend of mine is in town, but he's straight, so...
Do you really think he doesn't know about you?
It's a slight opening out of Mart Crowley's play, but that's what William Friedkin did in his own adaptation of the 1968 play sometime in the early 70s. The cast includes Jim Parsons, Zachary Quinto, and Matt Boomer, amongst various others, and they're all good.
Hey, everybody, game time. We all have to call the one person we truly believe we have loved.
My God, Michael, you're a charming host.
Who makes the first call?
This is an extremely well-acted movie, and it's also something of an object lesson in how to block eight or so characters in a very tight space in what is more or less a real-time event. But one thing about seeing the film now is to be reminded of all these jokes that are a part of our culture that actually got their start here. It's a controversial play. It was a groundbreaking play, but also controversial for one reason. Its portrayal of gay society and the variety of people associated with it. But we must remember that it was based more or less or inspired by Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And so the film does carry on with nightlife and heavy drinking and eventually game playing. And a lot of the characters who seem to be extreme caricatures actually turn out to be humanized and presented as complete people. But it is very well worth watching. And it's on Netflix, as I said. And now, let's hear from Matthew of Cable's Gremlin Dime with his weekly discovery.
Well, I'm going to quickly look at the new season for this really excellent dark comedy crime drama series, Fargo, created by Noah Hawley back in 2014. This is its fourth season. It's produced under the auspices of the Coen brothers, and very many elements of their films show up in these different series. As I said, this is set in Kansas City, 1950 this time. We've got a great performance by Chris Rock as the head of the Cannon organization, a crime family that's trying to take over from the Italian family. Jason Schwartzman plays the head of the Italian crime family. You may remember Schwartzman as the main villain in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Also in this is Jesse Buckley, who was recently in I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Ben Whishaw is in this. He plays Q on the recent James Bond movies. Also, Timothy Oliphant shows up. And especially nice is Emery Crutchfield as Etherita Smutley, who's our sort of heroine who kind of observes the events. And as we see, we've got the two powerful crime families, but there's these other sort of loose cannon agents of chaos characters who sets things in motion, and the powerful crime families kind of misinterpret it as an attack against them, and so they start, gets closer and closer to a big confrontation, and we're sort of watching this. One character mentions how only God knows the whole truth, and the way this narrative is presented, it's like we in the audience, we see more than the characters do. And so we know what other characters are doing and how they affect others. So that's really great. It's on Hulu right now, and that's the fourth season of Fargo. It's really good binge watching. Okay, back to DK.
Thank you, Matthew. And now this.
This is Britta Gordon, a contributor to the film show and podcast Film at 11. One of the most important things about KABU is that it is indeed community produced of, by, and for our community, with the wider listening public kept in mind as well, of course. KABU is a place where a diverse set of producers volunteer their time to create an outstanding range of material. So whether you've just found out about KBOO or have been a stalwart member for many years, your support is critical. You can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. And now, back to Film at 11.
Now let's hear from Jeff Godsoll, who this week selects from his website, The Essentials of Cinema, the documentary Night and Fog.
When the Allied forces liberated the concentration camps in Europe in 1945, there was a lot of footage shot of the horrors that were found there. Some of that footage was used at the Nuremberg trials of the following year, but for nearly a decade it remained mostly unseen. Then in late 1954, as part of the 10th anniversary of the liberation of France, an exhibit in Paris opened called Resistance, Liberation, Deportation. Producer Anatole Dauman visited the exhibit and proposed that a film be made. Originally intended to focus primarily on the deportation of resistance fighters and their internment in the camps, the film began to take shape when Dauman approached filmmaker Alain René, who at that time had done a handful of documentaries. At first reluctant, René agreed when Jean Cayrol agreed to write the narration. Cayrol himself had been a survivor of the camp at Mauthausen and had written of his experience in a memoir in 1946. The film was to be called Resistance and Deportation, adhering to its original theme and documenting the prison system inside the camps. The concept of the film began to change with René's involvement, and when the curators of the exhibit attended commemorations at Auschwitz in 1955 for the 10th anniversary of the liberation of that camp, it was decided to shoot footage in color of what remains of the camps today, contrasting with the archival footage in black and white. This would prove to be an eerie foreshadowing of the themes that would haunt all of René's future films, themes of time, memory, and perception. Beginning just a few years later with Hiroshima Mon Amour and last year at Marienbad. René had always intended to have the film raise larger issues than its original concept, pointing to moral questions rather than nationalistic ones, keenly aware that France itself was involved in atrocities of its own at the time in Algeria. The title was changed from Resistance and Deportation to Nuit et Brouillard, Night and Fog. Originally a German term, Nacht und Nebel, it was used to describe where all the deportees would disappear into, with the intention of them never to return. Night and Fog opens with the color footage, shot at Auschwitz, with railroad tracks now overgrown with weeds leading to the nearby camp. The narration by Cayrol is read by actor Michel Bouquet in a straightforward manner without emotional emphasis. Much credit goes to editor Chris Marker, who helped position Cayrol's pre-written and some added text to the images. After exploring the grounds and the ruins of the camp, we are taken back to where it all began, through carefully selected archival footage from various sources. We see the deportees as they are systematically, efficiently, led into the train cars for their last journey. As the horrors of the camps are revealed, the narration continues to elucidate and to ponder, as we do. By 1955, when Night and Fog was made, it had become well known, of course, that the extermination of the Jews was the intended outcome for the Nazis, and that the final solution involved the construction of new camps, containing gas chambers and crematoriums. Himmler's visit to Auschwitz in 1942, which precipitated this decision, is clearly shown in the film, and the decision to make new labor camps to help in the war effort is mentioned. But the final solution is not. This despite the images and the corresponding narration depicting the new arrivals, stripped immediately and led into the gas chambers under the guise of being cleansed. It becomes clear that Renee's avoidance of mentioning Jews, or even Germans for that matter, is deliberate. As the narration so eloquently suggests, these atrocities were not merely of a country against a race. The monster was never crushed, and the horrors now relegated to history. This was a human abomination, committed by humans upon other humans. So who ultimately bears the responsibility? The music for Night and Fog was by Hans Eisler, with the orchestra conducted by a young Georges Delarue. Eisler's score is remarkable. Unobtrusive early on, the music becomes more pronounced with the archival footage. As the images become more arresting, even shocking, the music, rather than trying to match or emphasize the image, goes the other way, becoming almost elegiac or pastoral. The effect is striking, as if to appeal to our better nature, to suggest a springtime where these atrocities remain unimaginable. At other times, when the images say it all, we hear only the plucking of strings. And finally, as we return to the present and to the color footage, and to the narration's plea to be vigilant lest these events be repeated, the music is tinged with sorrow, a lament for the dead. While there have been many films since 1955, both fictional and documentary, dealing with the Holocaust, including the 9.5-hour Shoah 30 years later, Night and Fog accomplishes its goal in barely over 30 minutes. François Truffaut called it the most noble and necessary film ever made. I would suggest that if you see only one film about the Holocaust, then Night and Fog is the one, and that everyone should. Night and Fog is available for viewing on the Criterion Channel, as well as on a newer Criterion DVD from 2016 in a beautiful new digital transfer using the original 35mm negative from Argos Films. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Before I turn to the BFI books, I want to revisit Sancho the Bailiff, which is the movie I talked about last week, and it's BFI production. One of my favorite writers was Robin Wood, and in a book called Favorite Movies, edited by Philip Nobley, he was one of 22 or more prominent film writers who talked about their favorite movie at the time. I want to read the last paragraph of his essay, The Seaweed Gatherer, which is about Sanshu Dayu. In the film's closing shot, the camera cranes up from the embracing mother and son, passes over the sea, comes to rest on the seaweed gatherer in a distant long shot, still at his work. An image of continuity, an acknowledgement of a wider world where other lives continue. But more than that, the seaweed, we realize, has been deposited by the tidal wave, which has wrought havoc and destruction, causing many deaths. But seaweed is also used as fertilizer, and it is for this purpose the old man is gathering it. The symbolism is quite unforced, incorporated naturally in the action, yet it epitomizes the tragic, affirmative movement of the whole film. The hope and possibility of new growth rested out of the most terrible devastation. In Sanshu Dayu, Mizoguchi's style, with its perfect balancing and harmonizing of sympathetic involvement and contemplation, reaches its fullest maturity. Few artists in any medium have achieved such mastery of technique, mastery of experience, mastery of self, three aspects of the same process. It is the greatest movie I have ever seen. So now I want to move back to the BFI books. I selected two this week because they are, you just couldn't find two movies that both reflected and deflected their times.
Warner Brothers presents Performance with Mick Jagger. And Mick Jagger. James Fox. and James Fox.
First up is Performance, made in 1968 but released about a year later, which starts out as a British crime film before turning into a psychedelic tale of a reclusive rock star played by Mick Jagger.
This is a film about madness and sanity.
It is a cult film, and it turns out one of the cult members is Colin McCabe, a British writer who normally does studies on Godard and others.
There's nothing wrong with me. I'm normal.
So it's a bit of a surprise to find that he's been an advocate of the movie since its appearance, and was selected to do the book on performance for the BFI Film Classics. His book is a template for how these volumes should be organized. It starts out with the production history, identifies the various biographies of the filmmakers. It chronicles the influence of the various criminals and London swingers and trendsetters, and also deals with the aftermath the film made.
Me. Would you call that equitable?
I see you down in San Antonio on a hot and dusty night. You're a baggy little leather boy with a smaller piece of stick. You're a lashing, smashing hunk of man.
Let's have a look.
Mr. McCabe makes large claims for the film, which, as we read, we accept. Though he does suggest that it is the first film set in the world of the East End villains, as they're called, not mentioning Joseph Losey's The Criminal from 1959, among others. But nevertheless, it's a good book in the series, well worth reading, and it's going to inspire you to watch the movie again, or to see it for the first time.
You'll still be in the circus when I'm laughing, laughing in my grave.
This is a film about fantasy and reality and sensuality. A film about death. And life. This is a film about vice. And Versa. Performance.
Well, what I want to move on to is a book, the book I've paired with it. A.L. Kennedy is a poet, a novelist, journalist, stand-up comic, among many other things, and has written an unusually confessional book on the importance of films by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger in her life, giving her a sense of home. Welsh, but with roots in Australia and Scotland, Kennedy doesn't feel as if she belongs in any one particular place. And it's around that theme that she circles the film The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. Blimp is based on a character in a popular comic strip, but fleshed out into a story that spans the First World War and into the Second, the film being released in 1943. Clive Candy, as played by Richard Livesey, is a distinctly non-blimpish military man, and the cost of his commitments is realized with motifs of his friendship with a German count, played by Anton Walbrook, and his frustrated involvement with three different women, all played by Deborah Carr, in an idea that might have been borrowed from a later novel by Thomas Hardy. If anything, Powell Pressburger are known here in the United States for The Thief of Baghdad or The Red Shoes, but their filmography is much richer than that. For a while, they were ridiculed as trying to bring culture and art and sophistication to movies, but in films such as The Small Back Room and I Know Where I'm Going, Powell and Pressburger show a knack for exploring the interesting nature of characters who are conflicted by their past and dreading their future.
You know that after the war, we had very bad years in Germany. We got poorer and poorer. Every day, retired officers and school teachers were caught shoplifting. Money lost its value. The price of everything rose, except of human beings. We read in the papers, of course, that the after-war years were bad everywhere, that crime was increasing and that the honest citizens were having a hard job to put the gangsters in jail. Well, I needn't tell you, sir, that in Germany, the gangsters finally succeeded in putting the honest citizens in jail. My wife was English. She would have loved to come back to England, but it seemed to me that I would be letting down my country in its greatest need, and so she stayed at my side. When in summer 33 we found that we had lost our children to the Nazi party, and I was willing to come, she died. None of my sons came to her funeral. Heil Hitler.
Ms. Kennedy adds, quote, not only did they anticipate the concept of the composed film, the potential of the jump cut, the visual projection of intimately psychological realities, and the modern interplay of film's medium and its message, and the voyeurism of its observers, they could also be frighteningly good at predicting the future, end quote. The book begins with her memories of the chill of Scottish weather and then her sense of alienation. Quote, I am cold, very cold, and something catches in my mind, the inarticulate punch of somewhere I can only summarize as home. I am thinking of home. I am a northeastern Scot, and I am walking through a yapping northeastern wind that happily sharpens itself between the buildings and spits narrow snow in my eyes. And this is how it always felt, the wind at home. It numbed the mouth and then the face, but reamed out the sinuses with splendidly cracking pain. It distorted vision, rounded shoulders, slowed uncomfortable time to a black iced stop, and even 20 years later it can wrench me back to a place where I want chicken rosato for dinner because it's Wednesday, and then an empty evening, not thinking of school, and then sleep under one particular purple quilt while the big outside stays outside, but shudders at the window frames. The second chapter contemplates the movie's opening scene, while chapter 3 summarizes a 5-point memo that Emmerich Pressburger sent to Wendy Hiller when she was originally planned as the female lead, which, quote, reaffirmed the responsibilities of independent filmmakers, end quote. Among the most interesting is number 4, quote, no artist believes in escapism, and we secretly believe that no audience does. We have proved at any rate that they will pay to see the truth for other reasons than her nakedness, end quote. Kennedy's response to that is, this means that their work will neither present me with something nasty, brutish, and probably very long, which claims it is realistic because it is unpleasant, nor will it tidy up human nature so that I will not find it disturbing. They give me the complexity and surreality of truth, and they do me the courtesy of assuming that I can understand it, or at least one or two levels. They have the strength of expression and clarity of conception to help me do that. End quote. The next chapter, actually number 4, is about the duel between Clive Candy and Theo.
Sie dürfen den Kampf erst auf das Kommando los beginnen. You will start only at the command los.
She writes, quote, an apparently cozy period drama is once again wavering on the brink of something quite different, something the MOI and Winston Churchill would not find it in their hearts to smile upon. Pedantic German efficiency and pride face British complacency and gamesmanship. We are looking at a war in miniature. Two unadmirable interest groups have decided they will settle their differences using the living bodies of men, men who have never met, who have no personal enmity, who have simply consented to bleed on behalf of others. She goes on to say later, The visual beauty of conflict, the adrenaline and release it could offer, will never be provided. Blimp will never offer the romance of violence, just as it will never be fooled by the double talk of politics. We will deal here with individuals and the decisions they must make. End quote. Part 5 discusses Clive Candy as a character and compares him with Churchill, who tried to suppress the film at the time, and then moves on to Anton Walbrook as Theo. The last chapter is addressing the issue of why the three women are all played by the same actress, Deborah Carr, and explores the film's theme of loss of home and love, concluding, I am certain that Powell and Pressburger and the life and death of Colonel Blimp are firmly a part of the home I carry within me, of that need for more and better, which I think is part of being alive. Although they can bring me close to despair when I think of all they represent and how much of it is now lost, they also provide encouragement, constructive anger, and hope, as good art should. When I find myself walking through Chinatown and feel a familiar cold, I am not lonely, and I am not completely undefined. Thus ends the book, but though that comes with a new 2020 foreword, it should be read as an afterword. It is packed with personal, cultural observations, and ends this way. I hope you enjoy the film. It was made in a dark time, was controversially nonconformist, and remains beautiful, compassionate, and filled with light. It's the kind of thing to keep you company. So that's it for Film at 11. We'll be back next week.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will be held on Saturday, September 21st at 1 p.m.